Guide Tell All, the podcast where tour guides share their favorite saucy bits of American history and also share some of their favorite lesser known or hidden gems around Washington, D.C. So this is one of our mini episodes. This is where we usually take you off the beaten path a little bit, talk about a site that you probably wouldn't see on your average walking tour. We're going to be talking today about a presidential memorial, which there are lots of in Washington, D.C. In fact, if you were to come take a tour with me, we would definitely see presidential memorials, but most likely we'd go see the Lincoln Memorial or the Jefferson Memorial, or we'd go to Capitol Hill and we'd see all the wonderful statues inside of the Capitol building. This is a presidential memorial that is really kind of hard to find. If you do see it, you're usually a little surprised at where it's at, and it's to a president who is not someone we would think of as deserving of a memorial today. So this should be a little tasty treat. The memorial I'm talking about is a memorial to President James Buchanan. The James Buchanan Memorial is unusual on many counts. Let's just start with the fact that President James Buchanan probably doesn't jump to the top of your list of presidents deserving of a memorial. Buchanan is often forgotten today, to say the least, and certainly by many historians considered one of the worst American presidents in our history. In addition to that, his memorial isn't on Capitol Hill. It isn't on the National Mall. It isn't in any sort of kind of federal core part of DC. It's tucked away in Meridian Hill Park, known to locals as Malcolm X Park. So it's really in the residential side of the city. It's in a place where all the other statues are allegorical or of other figures. It's not anywhere near any other presidential memorial. While Buchanan himself is a very divisive figure, and we're going to dive into that in a moment, I do find the story of how this memorial comes to be really fascinating because it sort of takes an unusual path. So let's take a moment to talk about James Buchanan. James Buchanan, widely considered one of our worst presidents. I think that's pretty indisputable if you look at the evidence, but he may be someone that you haven't heard that much about. So let me just kind of give you a little background. He has a really long government career, and frankly, if he had never set foot in the White House, he probably would be remembered today as a pretty nice statesman from Pennsylvania. That's where he's from. He's a prominent lawyer who moves into politics in the early 1800s. We're talking about a guy who serves at every level. State legislature, House of Representatives, United States Senate. He's a diplomat. He's Secretary of State. More than 30 years in public service. And that probably should have been good enough, right? He had had a long time in public service. He had initially been a Federalist in the early years of our country, but sort of becomes a Democrat to align himself with Andrew Jackson when Jackson's in the White House. So he's a Democrat from Pennsylvania. And as we get to the election of 1856, he is being put forth as the nominee for the Democratic nomination for the Democratic Party. He doesn't really campaign. He doesn't do anything himself. And when the Democratic convention comes together and says Buchanan is our man, he says, fine. He figures, okay, great. Well, if they elect me, they elect me. Now, he wins most likely because of the fact that it is a three-way race. In 1856, he's running as the Democrat. He's running against a former president, Millard Fillmore, who was then part of the Know Nothing Party or the American Party, and then John Fremont, who's a Republican. The way this election breaks out is basically a preview of what is to come. It's pretty much North versus South. He is going to win, Buchanan's going to win every Southern slave state with the exception of Maryland. And then he wins a couple of free states, most of them border states, and then his home state of Pennsylvania. Fremont's going to walk away with most of the North, but we're starting to see the North-South divide that is going to really explode in 1861. So Buchanan wins, and he could have seen the division there, tried to handle it diplomatically. He literally had been a diplomat, but he gives this really insane victory speech and basically just lambasts the Republican Party. He accuses them of attacking the South, of targeting the South specifically. when it comes to slavery, and he pledges that he's going to get rid of any sectional divide, that there's going to be nothing this federal government will do under his command that is going to target one particular part of the country. So he's going into this presidency making it very, very clear that he is going to be pro-slavery. His presidency, 1857, from the time he's sworn in to 1861, are four very bloody years in the United States. We are just inching closer and closer to the Civil War during those 4 years. And Buchanan's going to be at the heart of it every single time. When there's the fight over the addition of Kansas to the United States, whether it would be a free or slave state, he's going to support it being a slave state. And of course, as violence breaks out, bloody Kansas, he's going to sort of just kind of turn his back to that. He's not going to stop any of it, but he wants to make sure that he's supporting his party, the party of slavery at the time. He's going to support the decision made by the Supreme Court, the Dred Scott case, which denied a slave's petition for freedom. So we can see how he feels about that. He supports the Fugitive Slave Act. When John Brown's raid happens at Harper's Ferry, he's going to call for swift action against John Brown. And as all this violence and strife continues to build up to the war, he will do nothing in any way that would be perceived as trying to target the South. And so he lets so much of this go. He really just turns a blind eye. Now, he is not going to run for a second term. He's not very popular, so it wouldn't make any sense. But he had pledged at the beginning that he would be a one-term president, just like the man who'd come before him. So he's not going to run. And so naturally, he's not in the election. President Lincoln wins, or Abraham Lincoln wins the nomination. Abraham Lincoln wins the nomination. This is deeply upsetting in the South. And so Buchanan is still president, right? We have elections in the fall. We don't inaugurate our presidents till the spring in this era, in March at this time. And so Buchanan has to handle this. There is this tension boiling up. So he has to address secession. This puts Buchanan in a tough spot. Buchanan basically feels that he doesn't support Lincoln. He doesn't support these attempts to curb slavery, but he actually doesn't support secession either. He doesn't believe it's constitutionally possible. So in his final address to Congress, he talks about secession. And everybody's waiting to see what Buchanan's going to say, because Buchanan could possibly head this off, right? Maybe he could keep the country united, give Lincoln at least a fighting chance to start the country with us all united as one. And no, he gives this speech and he basically says, look, it's not legal to secede, but it's not legal for the federal government to prevent it. So he completely punts the issue. And then, as keeping with his sort of trend at this point, he's going to blame somebody else. He blames all of this on the northern states. He says that it's the North that's the problem. They're antagonizing against the South. And he says the only way to solve this problem is if we add a constitutional amendment that essentially protects slavery in the South, that protects the South, permanently enshrining slavery as an amendment. So that's Buchanan's big solution. So, real heck of a guy. Now, you might not know all that about Buchanan. If you have heard about James Buchanan, usually in a pop culture sense, you probably heard that he's our only bachelor president. He was never married at any point in his life. All of our other presidents have been married at some point, whether before, after, or during their presidency, and he has never. Today, there's a lot of scholarship and debate about what that means. There are certainly evidence to suggest he might have been gay or had homosexual sort of tendencies, or that he might have actually just been celibate. The most interesting figure kind of related to that aspect of Buchanan's life is William Rufus King. William Rufus King was a very close companion to Buchanan. They lived together. They went to social events together. Andrew Jackson called King Miss Nancy when he and James Buchanan were out and about. There were others who openly in letters referred to him as Buchanan's better half. We have evidence of times where King was referred to as Aunt Fancy, which at that time was basically the slang for sort of an effeminate male or someone who might have had tendencies. There were people who wrote about Buchanan after he died who said there was certainly something about him that seemed quite not right. And so there's a lot of, I think, talk today about Buchanan and what may or may not have gone on between him and King personally. The reason I mention King for this podcast, is this episode, is King is really going to be influential when it comes to Buchanan and his ideas about slavery. King is a very fervent pro-slavery Democrat, and he is, I think, really going to have the ear of Buchanan when Buchanan's wrestling with some of these things, when he's trying to decide what to do. It's really going to be King's influence, and he values King's opinion more than any other. So King has a great deal of influence over Buchanan, and I think he's going to be part of the reason that we have so much division that's sown during this time. So Buchanan's presidency is over. He does not live much longer after his presidency. 1861 is when he leaves office. He does kind of half-heartedly support the North in the Civil War simply because he feels that the South attacked Fort Sumter, a federal holding, and so they have to fight. So he sort of half-heartedly supports the North, but he is really, really unpopular. During the war, he's going to be targeted with angry and threatening letters. People are going to write, they'd send him cartoons and pictures of himself. Some people would send him a noose through the mail. They'd call him traitor. He tries to write a memoir to defend himself, which is published in 1866. He does a series of public letters in a newspaper called the National Intelligencer to try to win back over some public support. And he dies in 1867, very poorly thought of by the American people, a vast majority, and with very little respect from his peers. He had people who'd served in his cabinet, who were appointed by Lincoln for positions. Nobody would defend him publicly. Nobody would really come to his aid. So this is not a case where somebody was sort of beloved then and now we're sort of reevaluating. Even in this Civil War era, people had a problem with Buchanan, with his views, with his position, and the fact that he really led the country to this war. And at the time, it was not uncommon in a newspaper to see this referred to as Buchanan's War. This is a man who probably would have been totally forgotten about. He would be in the dustbin of history. He'd be a president that none of us, except for dorky tour guides and people who like to know weird things for pub trivia, would know about if it hadn't been for his niece, Harriet Lane. And this is a part of the story I find very interesting. Harriet Lane is his niece. She's orphaned at the age of 11, and she is adopted by James Buchanan, her favorite uncle. Buchanan is a terrible president, objectively, but as a mentor to this young woman, he's actually quite exceptional. He's really ahead of his time. He believes in educating her. He spoils her to a certain extent. She loves schooling, so she's going to get much more schooling than was common for women at the time. She's going to basically sort of run parallel to him. She'll be his companion when he travels. She's going to do diplomatic missions with him. He's going to take her to meet Queen Victoria and make her kind of part of that diplomatic circle. She's going to be his first lady while he's in the White House. And he's going to really, I think, boost her in her life in that he tells her you don't have to marry if you never want to. If you marry, you shouldn't marry rashly. You should wait till you're older and established. He helps her financially to make sure she is financially secure so she's not marrying out of desperation. And he really, I think, empowers her in a way that was not common at the time. She's pretty devastated, of course, when her beloved uncle dies in 1867. She does eventually marry at the age of 36. She's going to do very well for herself financially, but one of the passions of her life will be to try to preserve her uncle's legacy. So she does fund some stuff for him. She gets portraits painted. She funds a bust of James Buchanan, which today is at the National Portrait Gallery. If you've ever been walking through the portrait gallery and you've seen a bust of a man and it looks like he has a mohawk, that's James Buchanan. So now you know who the weird looking mohawk guy is at the National Portrait Gallery. She's going to die in 1903. When she dies, she's quite wealthy. She leaves a lot of money. She leaves it to John Hopkins so they can start an outpatient clinic for children. She's going to leave all of her artwork to the country, basically to the Smithsonian, so it can be part of their art collection. And she leaves in her will $100,000, about $3 million today, so a pretty good chunk of money, to a memorial to her uncle, President James Buchanan. So she says, here's the money, you're going to build a memorial. Let's just understand how memorials get built for a moment. Typically, if you want to build a national memorial, you have to have Congress say, this is our national memorial. We're going to build it. Here's federal land. You've got the support of the federal government. But then you need money. Almost all of our memorials in Washington, D.C. that are national memorials have been funded with private funds. Congress doesn't typically allocate the money for that. So she knows that by providing the money, she's making it way easier for Congress to say sure, because they don't have to worry about paying for it and nobody has to go out there and fundraise. So she's thinking this is going to be a pretty easy deal. But Congress is not known for acting swiftly, so she does put an expiration date on the money. She gives them this $100,000 with a 15-year deadline. July 2nd, 1918 would be the deadline, and if they cannot get a memorial built by that time or get a memorial approved by that time, the money will revert back to her estate. Now, this is 1903. We do not have any other presidential memorials in Washington, D.C. at the time, except for the Washington Monument. That's the only one we have. The National Mall does not exist as it exists today, with all these memorials and stately buildings. We do not have a heavy, strong history of national memorialization at this point. So this is a little odd. To have all of a sudden this money and this very strong request to build a memorial to a president. Not surprisingly, Congress doesn't jump on this. It's out of the norm. It's not usual. So Congress is just going to sort of ignore this until 1916. So 13 years go by, nothing happens. Congress has been ignoring this, but the Fine Arts Commission, which is sort of compelled to help create and keep these memorials or keep these projects moving, has decided to work on it. They're like, hey, there's all this money. As soon as Congress passes the bill, we want to be ready to go. So the Fine Arts Commission is already deciding where this memorial should go. By 1916, we're definitely seeing development of the National Mall, but the idea is still to have this beautiful green space, so they don't want to clutter it with memorials. So they instead turn their attention to Meridian Hill Park. For them, it's the perfect spot for the memorial. Meridian Hill Park had been sort of rededicated in 1910. It's this beautiful area. They had been talk a little bit earlier in this century about rebuilding the White House on the edge of Meridian Hill Park. So it was considered this really beautiful, stately area. They thought this would be a place where important Americans, diplomats and ambassadors and members of Congress would be walking by it every day. So it made a lot of sense to them that this would maybe be a place that you would tuck this presidential memorial. They decide they have enough money to do a grand bronze figure. So this is the plan. Meridian Hill Park, grand bronze figure, we just need Congress to get going. June of 1917 is the first time this is going to come to the floor. Representative Lithicum of Maryland will ask for unanimous consent to consider the resolution on a Buchanan memorial. He figures it should be an easy task. We have all the money, we have the location, we know what we're going to build, we just get this going, it's done. And Congress says no. Congress says absolutely not. We don't want to talk about this. We don't want to address it. No, thank you. So he can't even get the vote happening on a Buchanan memorial. So now it's 1918. 1918 is the year that this money expires, July. So we're getting closer and closer to the deadline. In February, this is going to come back to the floor of the House of Representatives again. There's going to be a 3-hour debate. There's massive opposition to this memorial. Of course, people who are opposed to it are going to talk about the slavery, his support of it. They're going to talk about secession and how he sort of botches this entire thing. So in 1918, even almost 60 years removed, there is not a lot of love for James Buchanan, even in the House where he had served for 11 years. Representative Len Root of Wisconsin said, "The best thing we can do for Mr. Buchanan is to forget him." Now, there's a lot of opposition, particularly from the Republican Party. They're going to filibuster for several days. But finally, this bill sort of squeezes through by the skin of its teeth on February 21st. Again, this is just mere months before the money is going to run out. The Senate really needs to address this, and they will in June of 1918. So we're really cutting it close on having access to the funds. June 1918. This is brought to the floor of the Senate, and an alleged row breaks out on the floor. There is shouts, there's anger, Per the Washington Post, the minute that Senator Smith of Maryland introduces the memorial, there is a storm of opposition that rises up against it. And it'll be Senator Lodge of Massachusetts, who's the most outspokenly opposed and who really rails against this memorial on the floor. He gives a harsh but not untrue sort of assessment of Buchanan. He says Buchanan was weak, timid, stubborn, incisive, vacillating, and disloyal, adhering to neither one cause nor the other in the crisis of the Civil War. And then he raises, I think, a very good point and one that was echoed in the Senate. To set up a statue of Buchanan in the Capitol, where there is no statue to the Elder Adams or Thomas Jefferson or Alexander Hamilton or James Madison or James Monroe or the youngest Adams, to me would appear to be a reflection upon these really great men. And I like what Senator Lodge says here because it's true. When you decide to build a memorial to something, you are, to an extent, legitimizing it, right? You're giving it value. You're giving it worth. You are often literally setting this person or figure on a pedestal. And so at this time, 1918, we don't have memorials to any of these founding fathers listed. And it would be like kind of implied approval of Buchanan from Congress to build this memorial. I don't think he's wrong about that. And I think it still is very much something to consider when we build memorials today, right? Whose stories do we tell? Who's valued enough to be honored in that way? Now, that's a pretty compelling argument, but Senator Smith of Maryland is going to counter with something that I find kind of ridiculous, but apparently worked to kind of swing opinion on the floor. He's going to use World War I as this kind of emotional touchstone. So when they're debating this bill in June of 1918, we have men fighting overseas in the First World War. And he is going to basically plead to say, let's let the past be the past. Why would we dig up these old controversies? Why are we raising up old, difficult history when our boys are dying in France for this country? And that apparently worked. This will pass the Senate pretty handily, all things said and done, 51-11 to approve the statue. So literally just days before the money runs out, the Buchanan Memorial is approved by Congress. Now, if you know a little bit about how things move in Washington, D.C., it's still going to take another 12 years for the memorial to actually be dedicated. So the memorial isn't dedicated until 1930. The memorial did not have a public dedication. That's pretty unusual. And I think just speaks to the fact that even in 1930, they know that there's not a lot of love for Buchanan. He's not a beloved figure. He's quite a controversial figure. And so they have sort of this private dedication. President Herbert Hoover presides over the dedication of this memorial. He will say nothing but nice things about Buchanan and sort of sing his praises. Now, I hope that you will go and see this memorial. It's very, it's unusual. It's interesting. It's certainly nestled in a beautiful park. But when you're in Meridian Hill Park and you see it, there's this grand bronze sculpture as envisioned by the Fine Arts Commission. He is seated, Buchanan in the center. He's flanked on either side by allegorical statues. We in Washington, D.C., we love our allegorical statues. And so on one side of him is law, a reference to his law career, which is how he began his kind of public life. And then on the other side is an allegorical statue of diplomacy. So a call to his time as a foreign minister and as Secretary of State. In his hand, he's holding a piece of paper. His head is kind of bent down a little bit. And so he's looking at this piece of paper. It is the Constitution. You can interpret that, I think, a lot of different ways. So I will leave it up to you when you go to visit. If you wanted to be generous, you might consider him sort of contemplating the Constitution, perhaps torn on this issue of the constitutionality of secession. If you wanted to be a little less generous, perhaps you might see him as sort of using the Constitution as a shield, right, as a reason not to make a decision, not to take action. Now, the memorial itself was done by an architect named William Gordon Beecher, but the sculpture, the beautiful bronze sculpture, was done by a man named Hans Schuller. And if you live in the region or if you spend time in our region and you go to Baltimore, you are very familiar with the work of Hans Schuller. Hans Schuller has done almost every major bronze sculpture that you see in Baltimore today. Most famously, the one of John Hopkins in Baltimore, but also Francis Scott Key, Pulaski, Lanier, a lot of really notable figures. So Schuller, quite well known for his work there, does very nice work with the Buchanan and the two allegorical figures. So it's a nice looking memorial. It's definitely an interesting memorial. I think my favorite slash most like rage inducing part though is the inscription. They didn't know what to write about him. This is not a man who's easy to memorialize and honor. And so they took a quote that had been written about Buchanan in his lifetime, and they put it there. And it's so insane when you think about Buchanan's actual legacy that these are the words on his memorial. President James Buchanan, the incorruptible statesman whose walk upon the mountain ranges of the law. Okay, sure. I mean, right. He was a lawyer. He was a statesman. He perhaps at points in his career tried to uphold the law, but it really is, again, this sort of weird way of trying to frame his legacy as being more measured or more more balanced than it really, really was. So that is our James Buchanan Memorial. He is a tough figure to talk about. I think in terms of the fact that he's got such a complex legacy and he is president at a time and he exacerbates the time that leads to the Civil War. But I also sort of love that because of the relationship he had with his niece, she worked really hard to make this happen. And this was despite all the debate and opposition, Congress did ultimately decide to memorialize this president. And so we do have this memorial in this residential part of D.C. today. To sort of cap this off, I do get asked all the time as a tour guide, you know, which presidents get memorials? And it's hard to explain why, right? There isn't a set list. It's not as though Congress has said, we're going to do them in order. It's not as though Congress has said, these are the 20 best, so they get them. These memorials get made in different ways. There's different motivation for why. And for Buchanan, it is simply because his niece had $100,000 ready for it, and she put a timeline on the money. So that's how a presidential memorial can get made. Now, I hope that you've been enjoying Tour Guide Tell All. If you like what you're hearing, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. We have not just these great mini episodes, but we also have longer episodes that dig into historical figures and events. We have some great episodes coming up for the rest of the summer, so I hope that you'll tune in. If you are on Twitter, be sure to follow us at Tour Guide Tell, at Tour Guide Tell. We are always here to answer your questions, talk more in depth about any of these figures. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And if you have suggestions for future topics, we would love that. Be sure, of course, if you're enjoying the podcast, to be a patron. On our Patreon, you can get access to all kinds of special features. You can get live streams of us. You can get behind-the-scenes videos. You can even get your own virtual tour with one of our great tour guides. So we definitely would love to see you on the Patreon, and we're so appreciative of all of our listeners who are already patrons.
Next time on Tour Guide Tell All, we celebrate Juneteenth and look at the life and times of Frederick Douglass.
Talk about, because his life is so expansive. Like you said, it really does reflect this incredible roller coaster of race in America, mm-hmm. and of so much change, how much the country changes for the good and for the worse between the 1840s and the in 1900. I look forward to talking to you guys soon. Thank you so much for listening. This has been Becca, Tour Guide Tell All.